the Savitri Swadhyaya Satra, that's what we call it, Savitri Study Camp of the year 2003. We launched on this venture about 15 years ago, and our first word always has been invocation, the mother's presence and protection. This is from page 699. This is the Supreme Divine addressing Savitri and assuring her that her mission on earth is a very great mission and it will be fulfilled. O sun world, thou shalt raise the earth soul to light and bring down God into the lives of men. Earth shall be my work chamber and my house, my garden of life to plant a seed divine. When all thy work in human time is done, the mind of earth shall be a home of light, the life of earth a tree growing towards heaven, the body of earth a tabernacle of God. Awakened from the mortal's ignorance, men shall be lit with the eternal's ray, and the glory of my sun lift in their thoughts, and feel in their hearts the sweetness of my love, and in their acts my power's miraculous drive. My will shall be the meaning of their days, living for me, by me, in me, they shall live. In the heart of my creation's mystery, I will enact the drama of thy soul, inscribe the long romance of thee and me. I'll pursue thee across the centuries. Thou shalt be hunted through the world by love, naked of ignorance, protecting veil, and without covert from my radiant gods. No shape shall screen thee from my divine desire. Nowhere shalt thou escape my living eyes. In the nudity of thy discovered self, in a bare identity with all that is, disrobed of thy covering of humanity, divested by the dense veil of human thought, made one with every mind and body and heart, made one with all nature and with self and God, summing in thy single soul my mystic world, I will possess in thee my universe. The universe find all I am in thee. Thou shalt bear all things, that all things may change. Thou shalt fill all with my splendor and my bliss. Thou shalt meet all with thy transmuting soul. Assailed by my infinitudes above and quivering in immensities below, pursued by me through my mind's wallless vast, oceanic with the surges of my life, a swimmer lost between two leaping seas, by my outer pains and inner sweetnesses, finding my joy in my opposite mysteries, thou shalt respond to me from every nerve. A vision shall compel thy coursing breath. Thy heart shall drive thee on the wheel of works. Thy mind shall urge thee through the flames of thought to meet me in the abyss and on the heights, to feel me in the tempest and the calm, and love me in the noble and the vile, in beautiful things and terrible desire. The pains of hell shall be to thee my kiss, the flowers of heaven persuade thee with my touch. My fiercest masks shall my attractions bring. Music shall find thee in the voice of swords. Beauty pursue thee through the core of flame. Thou shalt know me in the roaring of the spheres and cross me in the atoms of the world. The reeling forces of my universe shall cry to thee the summons of my name. Delight shall drop down from my nectarous moon. My fragrance seize thee in the jasmine's snare. My eye shall look upon thee from the sun. Mirror of nature's secret spirit made, thou shalt reflect my hidden heart of joy. Thou shalt drink down my sweetness unalloyed in my pure lotus cup of starry brim. My dreadful hands laid on thy bosom shall force thy being bathed in fiercest longing streams. Thou shalt discover the one and quivering note and cry the harp of all my melodies and roll my foaming wave in seas of love. Even my disastrous clutch shall be to thee the ordeal of my rapture's contrary shape. In pain's self shall smile on thee my secret face. Thou shalt bear my ruthless beauty unabridged amid the world's intolerable wrongs, trampled by the violent misdeeds of time. Cry out to the ecstasy of my rapture's touch. All beings shall be to thy life my emissaries, drawn to me on the bosom of thy friend, compelled to meet me in thy enemy's eyes. My creatures shall demand me from thy heart. Thou shalt not shrink from any brother soul. Thou shalt be attracted helplessly to all. Men seeing thee shall feel my hands of joy. In sorrow's pangs, feel steps of the world's delight. Their life experience its tumultuous shock. In the mutual craving of two opposites, hearts touched by thy love shall answer to my call. Discover the ancient music of the spheres in the revealing accents of thy voice, and nearer draw to me because thou art enamored of thy spirit's loveliness. They shall embrace my body in thy soul. Hear in thy life the beauty of my life, of my love. Know the thrilled bliss with which I made the worlds. All that thou hast shall be for others' bliss. All thou art shall to my hands belong. I'll pour delight from thee as from a jar. I will whirl thee as my chariot through the ways. I will use thee as my sword and as my lyre. I'll play on thee my minstrelsies of thought. And when thou art vibrant with all ecstasy, and when thou livest one spirit with all things, then will I spare thee not my living fires, but make thee a channel for my timeless force. My hidden presence led thee unknowing on, from the beginning in earth's voiceless bosom, through life and pain and time and will and death, through outer shocks and inner silences, along the mystic roads of space and time, to the experience which all nature hides. Who hunts and seizes me, my captive grows. This shalt thou henceforth learn from thy heartbeats. Forever love, O beautiful slave of God, O lasso of my rapture's widening noose, become my cord of universal love. The spirit ensnared by thee, forced to delight of creation's oneness sweet and fathomless, compelled to embrace my myriad unities and all my endless forms and divine souls. O mind, grow full of the eternal peace. O world, cry out the immortal litany. Built is the golden tower, the flame child born. When you read a passage like this, You don't like to speak in prose. So I had half a temptation to go on reading it. It's a long passage of great sublime poetry of the kind 20th century hasn't seen, and 21st century I don't know whether it will say anything like this. So I thought, purify the atmosphere and keep all our adversaries at bay. So we are now safe for the next 10 days to sit in peace and read as much as we want from Savitri. The second thing I would like to do is to thank all of you who have been keeping me company since we began this venture several years ago. As I have always said, Savitri is not a book on which you can write a commentary. It's not a book on which you can give lectures. It's a book, I guess, on the basis of which you can perform a dance, a book on the basis of which you can sing. There are a number of things you can do, and whatever you do, this is an infinite source of knowledge, of power, and of delight. And since I am neither a dancer nor a singer, nor an artist, the only thing I know is to celebrate it with my voice. And I have been doing it for the last so many years, and many of you have been with me. So thank you very much for being co-participants in this sacrifice that has been going on for the last 15 years now. Now, one of the reasons we study Savitri is that it is the spiritual biography of the mother. Besides, it's also the spiritual autobiography of Sri Aurobindo. There is a third reason. It also gives you the biography of evolution. What evolution means, why it has come about, what stages it has gone through, and how we as human beings, human consciousness, represents the apex of this evolutionary journey. And after man, who and how and where? All these questions are answered here. Now, as we know, we completed after a sort, in a manner, book 11 last time. All that remains for us to do this time is book 12, the epilogue, which is about 10 pages long. Now, what I propose to do during this study camp is first go to these 10 pages, and then instead of reviewing the previous the work that we did in the last camp, I would like you to review parts of Savitri under various heads. So it will be a kind of going through the whole of Savitri with different foci, different, each time I will choose a different focus, and I will try to bring back to your memory some of the things we did several years ago. Now, before that, we also need to do something else, and that is remember that this is the 125th birth anniversary of the mother, and we have been celebrating the mother's birth, the mother's work, the mother's presence here during the last 15 years. So I thought, on behalf of all of us, before we start our Savitri reading, we would pay our homage, our gratitude once again in words, and that's what I would like to do during the first session this morning. I would like to ask the question, who is the mother? Why do we call her divine? And remind ourselves, not because you don't know the answer to it, but reminding ourselves the answer to this question is very salutary. The fact that we get an opportunity to go to the samadhi whenever we want, or go to mother's room once or twice a year, or Sri Aurobindo's room more often, they tends to dull the edge of our aspiration. They're all here, they're all ours, all that we have to do is just walk up. We don't know what a great grace it has been that we come here year after year, and that before we have become doddering old men, we have discovered Sri Aurobindo and the mother. So it helps once in a while to remind ourselves of our great good fortune. And I think what I am going to do in the next 45 minutes is an exercise of that kind. So the world doesn't know much about the mother. Many people, sociologists, anthropologists, political busybodies, etc., have tried to study the mother, who this is. And as Sri Aurobindo says, they try to understand her by their little earthly mind that loves to subject even the things that are beyond it to its own norms and standards, its narrow reasonings and erring impressions, its bottomless aggressive ignorance, and its petty self-confident knowledge. So people have tried to do it, and one worthy came to the conclusion that the mother was no more than a French tourist who went to Pondicherry and discovered that she was a goddess. A tremendous discovery. He should probably narrowly miss the Nobel Prize. Nobel Prize is normally given to such people. But there are people like Kapali Shastriya, as we all know, who spent a whole lifetime in mantra upasana, puja, aradhana, various kinds of traditional forms of worship. And Madhav Pandit, in an introduction to a book written by Kapali Shastriya, a book very well known, I don't know, Flame of White Light, that's the name of that book, says towards the very end of Shastriji's life, Kapali Shastriya, as you know, spent all his life in traditional forms of worship, various kinds of traditional forms. Sri Vidya, Mantra Vidya, you name it, he had practiced it. Then he was a disciple of no less a person than Kavyakanta Ganapati Muni, who was himself regarded a Rishi of that time. Then he was a favorite disciple of Raman Maharshi. And finally, when he came and settled down here, for him he lived almost in ecstasy, because he knew he lived here in this ashram in the vicinity of Sri Aurobindo and the mother. So Madhav Pandit writes, during his last days, on one occasion, Kapali Shastriya was lying on his bed exhausted, and Madhav Pandit asked him, Shastriya, he said, you have spent a whole lifetime doing all this tapascharya. What has been your siddhi? What did you gain? Then it seems Kapali Shastriya suddenly shot up, sat down on his bed and said, the greatest siddhi of my life has been that I know who the mother is. That has been the greatest siddhi. So even to understand, to know who the mother is, you need the kind of tapasya that Kapali Shastriya went through. And in one of his books, Kapali Shastriya describes, he says, I saw and recognized in her a conscious embodiment of the whole divine, a living murti, in whom are present all the four personalities of the Adya Shakti, spoken of by Sri Aurobindo as presiding over the course of the earth's evolution. This is what Kapali Shastri saw in her. As you know, Sri Aurobindo himself wrote a little big book called The Mother, to explain to people who the mother was. Because, let us face it, when the mother became the mother of the ashram, until then people thought that she is some kind of a postgraduate student of Sri Aurobindo, doing advanced yogic research. But then when she recognized her as the mother and asked everybody to approach her for guidance in their yoga, many fertile Indian brains must have thought, why a French lady? Why a French mother? There must have been many capable Indian ladies. Why not some Saraswati or some Janaki or some Sita or Lakshmi? Why this French lady? Well, as you know, we are as narrow, as chauvinistic as anybody else in the world, even when we come to spiritual life. We are no exception. then Shurvindo then, in order to answer the questions raised by genuine seekers, wrote this little book called The Mother. And in that little book he has answered all these questions. And to me, nobody has described the mother better than Sri Aurobindo. And here is a line which I think gives succinctly a very good idea who the mother was. He says, the one whom we adore as the mother is the divine conscious force that dominates all existence, one and yet so many-sided that to follow her movement is impossible even for the quickest mind and for the freest and most vast intelligence. The mother is the consciousness force of the Supreme, and far above all, she creates. Now the question I want to raise here is that your guru is always the divine for you. Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru, all this we know. It is sanctioned by tradition that you have to see the divine in your guru. Now the question is our mother divine in that sense? Is she a divine for an occult? After all, the world looks at us as a cult, or they are a religious cult or whatever. We may not like this description, but the world doesn't know any better. So is the mother divine just for us people who come to Pondicherry, or people who subscribe to All India magazine, or people who become members of Sri Aurobindo society, or has she a relevance to the world at large? This is a question I want to raise. Now, the term divine may irritate some people, because today we respect philanthropy, we respect charity, we respect building of free hospitals, etc., etc. But spirituality is something the modern age has no sympathy with. And so, divine for many people is just a psychological prop. There is nothing like divine. God doesn't exist. God is something we cast in our own image for whatever psychological benefits that we want. In Savitri itself, Sri Aurobindo at one time points out, through the words of the God of death says to Savitri, you are talking about God. You know what God is? Children sleep by themselves in many parts of the world, right from the age of one or age of two. In India, they are always with other people. Now, suddenly at night you wake up at 2:30 and 3 o'clock, you find yourself all alone in the bed, there is nobody else in the room, and the curtain is fluttering, the owl is hooting somewhere, and the wind is blowing, and you are scared, there is nobody, mama and papa aren't there around, they must be somewhere else in some other part of the house. Then what do? You are scared stiff. So to create in you some kind of a psychological confidence, in Western countries, children are often advised to go to bed with their dolls, little dolls, Barbie doll or whatever doll. You take that doll to bed, so when you wake up, you fumble for this doll, and when you see this doll, you feel reassured, you have some company, there is somebody there. So the God of death says, God is no more than this psychological doll for grown-up children. There is no God. So all these rationalists have concluded, gods don't exist. And if they exist, they are your fiction, and you want somebody to listen to your prayers, we are helpless. So make sure that my daughter gets a good husband, my son gets a good job, etc., etc. Therefore you pray somebody, even if it is fiction, you like to pray, and hoping that some of these prayers will be heard, others may not be heard. So what is the loss? So you pray. God is nothing more than that. And of course, there are various kinds of criticism against God. Gods are all sitting there in the seventh heaven. They know no tears, they have no suffering, they don't know death, they don't know want. So it's nice to be a god and sit there in the seventh heaven. So we don't want such gods. This is the modern intellectuals' kind of rage against gods. Well, all that we can say is, while we can commiserate with the moral anger of the modern intellectual against gods, it is simply not true that gods don't exist. They do exist. They do exist at certain level. But the problem with the gods is, the quality of your life doesn't depend on the gods you worship. The quality of your life depends on the gods you can incarnate in your heart. It doesn't matter whether we worship Venkatesha or Lakshmi or Shiva or whatever. Gods in their own place are very great. But how much of this have you incarnated in your life? That's the important thing. And we tend to make gods in our own image, Aurobindo explains it, because since our consciousnesses are so opaque, their capacity to reflect the divine influence is so limited, very often the reflection that we get in our consciousness is distorted, and distorted according to our image, according to our psychological bent. So sometimes we are cruel gods, sometimes we are jealous gods, etc. It is not the fault of the gods, it is the fault of the consciousness which reflects these influences. Secondly, on the quivering theater of our heart, there are not only influences from the gods, but there are also influences from the hostiles. And Sri Aurobindo and the mother have written quite a bit about these. And thirdly, our own consciousness has arisen from the inconscient. So it has on it a strong stamp of ignorance and the inconscient. So on the one hand, your consciousness, which is the receptacle for all influences, is itself partly tarnished because of its origin. In that, you receive influences from gods, you receive influences from the hostiles, and a war has been going on constantly between the what we call the daivik forces and the asuric forces. This has been going on and on for several generations. And it looks as if, so far, the asuric forces are most of the time victorious. Gods are always driven and the asuric forces triumph. Otherwise, how do you explain so much evil, so much corruption in the name of the state, in the name of religion, in the name of God? Notice, for example, the tendency to exploit the weak has always been there in society. It was there in feudalism, it continued in capitalism, it flourished during socialism. And so, no matter what gods you worship, our heart has not benefited. The gods have not so far been successful in cleansing the human heart, in increasing in the human heart sympathy, compassion and love. That is, in other words, the gods that we worship may occasionally give you little toys, little returns, good health, good bank balance, success, fame, but modern gods even built 1,000-bed hospitals. Even that they are capable of doing. 1,000-bed hospital, great work, wonderful work. But first of all, it assumes that thousands and thousands of people will fall ill and they are going to need the hospital. So you go on building hospitals. Nobody is asking, why do people fall ill? Why is there exploitation? Why do you need Mother Teresa's? Mother Teresa is a great icon. She has been given Bharat Ratna and so on. There is nothing higher than Bharat Ratna, so she was not given anything higher. So why do we need all these things? We need all these things because our hearts are too narrow. And because our hearts are too narrow, Mussolini's, Hitler's, Stalin's, Idi Amin's, Osama bin Laden's, come out every 50 years. And we all think we are not responsible for it. But I am not convinced that we are not responsible for it. all these evil-minded people are just concrete manifestations of the evil that exists in our hearts. The evil that we are unable to extinguish, completely throw out, it's there all the time. Who is producing Hitlers? Who is producing Idi Amins? Who is producing Osama bin Ladens? You and me. Gautam Buddha said a long time ago that the human consciousness is such that when it receives a vibration of evil, it is incapable of turning it into a vibration of good and sending it back. When I receive a vibration of evil, what do? I give it a little more strength and send it back. So we all keep contributing to the fund of evil in this earth, and we bathe 3 times a day and feel very pure. Externally we are very pure, but the consciousness that we have inside us, you ask yourself, you see the society in which you live and ask yourself, are we not partly responsible for the society in which we live? This is the basic thing. The mother once has said, and I was amazed that the mother said this, Mahishasura Mardini, Durga comes down and kills Mahishasura, but she has to come down every year. Don't you celebrate Dasera every year? What does it show? This year she comes down and destroyed Mahishasura, but the remaining 364 days we are all busy recreating other Mahishasuras, and again she has to come down. So gods have become basically ineffectual in making, purging our hearts of limitations, of cupidity, of selfishness, of egoism, of the tendency to exploit. Now we want gods who can do this. We want gods not merely for better crops in our farms. We want gods not only who will increase production in our industrial plants. We want gods who will purge human hearts of all the limitations, particularly of egoism. Do you know what is bothering the world today? What is bothering President Bush? It is egoism. Do you know what is bothering the Islamic fundamentalists? It is egoism. They all have great truth within themselves, but this gets twisted, warped, frustrated, because egoism has occupied it. Now which God can purge your heart of egoism? And therefore Sri Aurobindo and the mother said, the gods belong to the over-mental age. The gods have done their best. The gods have produce the world as we see it, but they have not been able to find a permanent solution to the problems of humanity, which are not external problems, which are problems here in our heart. As many scientists have come to the conclusion, the limits of our happiness are no more external limits. The limits of our happiness are all internal limits. Who will change the texture of our consciousness? How can we change it? How can we have a consciousness which automatically has unity in it, oneness in it, harmony in it, love in it? Now we have a consciousness called the mental consciousness, which has great sharpness, great smartness, but great egoism. And so, what Sri Aurobindo and the mother represents is this, this need to bring down greater gods on earth so that they can cleanse the human heart. All pottering, all remedial work is of no avail whatsoever. We have been doing it. Once Idi Amin comes or once Osama bin Laden comes, professors at Stanford and Harvard and other places get busy and produce big tomes. This is the reason why Hitler had to come the way he came. This is all explanation. But is there a way of preventing a recurrence of these evil-minded people? Is there a way of doing it? We don't know. We have to wait until they come and then we write scholarly tomes. Sri Aurobindo wrote a long time ago, these will continue. these will appear, more and more evil will come down, because human heart is waving out a constant, permanent invitation to evil, because the mental consciousness has this limitation. And therefore, to go beyond the mental consciousness, as you know, in Savitri itself, as Savitri proceeds looking for her soul, she meets on the way some gods, goddesses, and they come and tell her, "Oh Savitri, we are your soul." And these gods, are some of them are gods who are quite familiar to you. Durga, Kali, Lakshmi, all these goddesses come to Savitri. On page 509, there is a goddess who says, "Men hail in my coming the Almighty's force, or praise with thankful tears his savior grace. I smite the titan who bestrides the world, and slay the ogre in his bloodstain. Then I am Durga, goddess of the proud and strong, and Lakshmi, queen of the fair and fortunate. I wear the face of Kali when I kill. I trample the corpses of the demon hordes. I am charged by God to do his mighty work. Uncaring, I serve his will who sent me forth. Reckless of peril and earthly consequence, I reason not of virtue and of sin, but do the deed he has put into my heart. I fear not for the angry frown of heaven. I flinch not from the red assault of hell. I crush the opposition of the gods, tread down a million goblin obstacles. I guide man to the path of the divine." As Savitri progresses, she meets these Madonnas of compassion and love, Madonna of might, Madonna of wisdom. But notice, as soon as each of these Madonnas stops, Savitri suddenly begins to hear a perverted form of these Madonnas. Which means, whatever God sent here, the evil is capable of perverting it. No matter what you bring, no matter what grace descends from heaven, there is something in the mental consciousness which is capable of perverting it. This is something human beings have not yet understood. They simply think, we'll bring a better edition of this, we'll bring a better edition of Durga, we'll bring a better edition of Kali. That doesn't help, because the human heart has a capacity to pervert all these. And that is why Savitri says, "Look, you are part of my soul, but I still have to go farther and bring other gods, because you have not yet been able to do the basic thing needed, which is transform human nature. For that, you need something else." And the mother and Sri Aurobindo, as we all know, took up precisely this task, and they have brought down new gods, or new capacities which the human heart can now assimilate, such that in the war that is going on between the asuras and the devas, please do not think this is a war that is going to happen in Iraq, or that has happened in Kuwait, or in Europe. This is a perennial war that's going on in the quivering theater of our heart. We are all participants in this war. But the net result has always been, either the gods get defeated, or by the time they are victorious, they are exhausted. Gods are by that normally a weak race. They are not powerful. You know, in the Amrut Manthan, you know, they churned the whole ocean. The pot of nectar came. You know who got it?
The Rakshasas got it. God simply kept wringing their hands in vain, "I wish I had got it." Then the Supreme Divine had to play a trick on the Rakshasas and snatch it back and give it to the gods. God has been doing this, and that's why the Supreme Divine has been doing this, and therefore we are still surviving this world. But that's not good enough. And Sri Aurobindo and the mother therefore brought down here to earth, as the mother said on 29 February 1956, the supramental consciousness has descended on earth. This is no mean achievement, this is no small achievement. And Savitri gives us the spiritual history to the background of this great war, which Sri Aurobindo describes in a God's Labor, in that great poem called the God's Labor. All this has happened. The new gods are here, and yet human beings are not tired of worshipping old gods. The mother herself has said, the age of religions is over, and all the overmental gods belong to the age of religions. Somebody asked mother a question. Then this is the question. Once one has taken the path of Sri Aurobindo's yoga, should not one stop worshipping all other gods and goddesses? And this was the answer mother gave this person. One who truly follows the path given by Sri Aurobindo, as soon as he begins to have the experience of the path, will find it impossible to confine his consciousness to the worship of any god or goddess, or even all of them put together. Speaks little of the Divine Mother, because its object, please listen to this carefully, its object, the object of the yoga of the Vedanta, is to draw back from world nature. And arrive at the supreme realization beyond it. The tantric tradition leans on the Shakti or Ishwari aspect and makes all depend on the Divine Mother, because its object is to possess and dominate the world.